Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the bond between Americans and the men and women charged with keeping them safe in their communities is going through tough times. In a world of dash cams and smartphones, we've now seen police beating, shooting African Americans and more. We've seen the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, Justice Department investigations, consent decrees. Police have their own litany of losses and complaints. Those are growing louder, too. This hour on Point, on this Martin Luther King Day, a progress report on policing in post-Ferguson America and where we are headed in the time of Donald Trump. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen improved policing in your neighborhood, your community, smarter policing, or the same? Police officers, how do you see what's happening? Are you staying in your squad cars? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Wesley Lowery, Pulitzer Prize-winning national reporter covering law enforcement, justice, race, and politics for The Post. He was one of the lead reporters for The Washington Post coverage of fatal shootings nationwide by police officers in the line of duty, was himself arrested in Ferguson in 2014. He's the author of They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Wesley Lowery, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us on this Martin Luther King Day.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Big news last week from Chicago and Baltimore. Give us a sense of what's going on there with the Justice Department, what's been found, what's been agreed to.
Certainly. And so there were two major investigations still outstanding from the Obama Justice Department and questions of whether or not they would be done prior to the inauguration and the transition of administrations. Those were the consent decree process in Baltimore. We had seen the results of the investigation there, and they had issued a pretty damning report which alleged civil rights violations by the Baltimore PD. This was an investigation prompted by the death of Freddie Gray back in 2015.
Yep.
And we were awaiting word of whether or not the city would reach a binding agreement with the federal government, and that was announced last week. And meanwhile, we had a similar investigation that was still outstanding in Chicago. In Chicago, this is an investigation prompted by a series of shootings, but specifically the Laquan McDonald shooting that occurred in 2014, and then the outrage that the video of that shooting was withheld for a year. Now, the Department of Justice released its initial set of findings, as well as announced some real progress and a consent decree with city officials. And in those findings, they found what they found in many of the cities they've investigated, right? And so they were finding kind of routine patterns of potentially unconstitutional behavior, talking about things such as lack of investigation for shootings that are non-fatal, talking about a kind of code of silence, talking about an outdated police training video. One of the training videos that they used to train Chicago police is as old as Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then they also were talking about, uses of force that perhaps are either unconstitutional or should not be, such as shooting at fleeing felons or shooting at fleeing suspects in general, as well as shooting at fleeing vehicles, which is something that is banned by both the Chicago PD's policy as well as many departments around the country.
Here was Attorney General Loretta Lynch in a press conference last week talking about the Chicago Police Department, saying it failed both its citizens and its officers.
During the course of our investigation, the department heard from countless officers who were themselves disillusioned and discouraged by strained trust, by inadequate training, poor oversight, and inattention to officer wellness and safety. Now, those officers are proud to wear the badge, but they recognize that they lack the support, both from the community and from the city, to properly do their jobs.
Chicago Sun-Times reporting out of that Justice Department investigation that the Chicago police have shot at fleeing suspects who were not an immediate threat, used force to retaliate against people, failed to address racially discriminatory behavior within the department, put their own officers at risk with all of that. And there are some kind of incredible stories coming out here. The Chicago police, Wesley Lowery, saying that they would take a young person to a rival gang neighborhood and either leave that person there or just display the youth to rival members, putting their
the life of that young person in jeopardy by suggesting that he's provided information to police. Pretty rough stuff.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and again, this is not unlike many of the things. Now, it's kind of geographically and location specific, but it's not unlike what we read about the Baltimore Police Department or the Ferguson Police Department in the previous consent decrees. I mean, as a general rule, when the Department of Justice comes in to conduct one of these investigations, they are finding the places in which the behaviors of the police department are not matching the ideals of American policing, right? And so these, as we lay these out, these examples out, these certainly are striking, and it begins to provide some illumination as to perhaps why there is such distrust in many of these neighborhoods of the police. But again, knowing what anecdotally, having spoken and interviewed a lot of people in these neighborhoods, many of these findings are not particularly surprising.
Of course, police have their own reactions to this, and responding to the last few years of Black Lives Matter kind of scrutiny of their work. Questions as well about what federal policy will be under the Trump administration. We had Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, of course, in his hearings before the Senate last week. And he said that the country's post-Ferguson attention on police risked branding entire police departments with the actions of a few, said Senator Sessions, a few abusive cops.
There's concern that good police officers and good departments can be sued by the Department of Justice when you just have individuals within a department who have done wrong, and those individuals need to be prosecuted.
Kind of a few bad apples argument there, Wes Lowry, and this, that the lawsuits, the consent decrees, he said, are that the potential next, the nominee for attorney general said they undermine respect for police officers.
These lawsuits undermine the respect for police officers and create an impression that the entire department is not in doing their work consistent with fidelity to law and fairness, and we need to be careful before we do that.
There, Senator Jeff Sessions on his way, very likely to becoming Attorney General of the United States. Of course, we don't know. We'll see. Wes Lowry, you've been covering this for a long time. Where are we in the arc of policing post-Ferguson here? We've got these consent decrees with major police departments. You followed the numbers a lot at the Washington Post in terms of numbers of death, in terms of police behavior and the quality of policing. Is there an advance underway? Can you tell or not?
Well, it's difficult to tell, in part because policing is such a decentralized structure and system in the United States of America. There are 19,000 police departments, and so one or two police departments undergoing reforms, completely changing their ways, doing something different, is actually not doesn't do much to change the overall arc of policing. Now, that said, we're certainly you know, we have not seen any downtick in the number of fatal police shootings. We saw about the same number of fatal police shootings in 2016 as we saw in 2015. It is unclear if there will be any additional reforms next year that do anything to push down that number any further. But we also are certainly, as it relates to the federal posture towards policing, we're at a moment of what is very likely to be great change. You know, we've listened to we listened to those clips from Jeff Sessions, who is very likely to become the Attorney General, and that does not inspire much confidence that his Department of Justice would continue to investigate or hold to account very aggressively local police departments. And that comes at a time when Loretta Lynch, I believe, just wrote an op-ed for USA Today calling police violence the civil rights issue of our time, right? And so that those could not be further apart from each other. It seems very unlikely that the practice of the White House, which has been kind of championed under both Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch as being a clearinghouse for best practices, a data collection arm, a place that is talking about issues of police reform, that seems very unlikely to continue based on the rhetoric we've heard so far from President-elect Trump as well as from the, you know, presumptive Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
Jeff Sessions saying morale, police morale has been affected, and he said it's impacted crime rates in Baltimore, crime rates in Chicago. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I want to look at that and test that. Wes Lowry, please stand by. Rich Morin joins us right now from Washington, senior editor at the Pew Research Center, co-author of the new Pew study, Behind the Badge. Rich Morin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
You talked with a lot of police officers, 8,000, maybe the biggest survey ever. What did you find about police morale in this era, Rich?
We found that there's been a great response among police officers to both the fatal encounters, the protests that those encounters generated, and the whole national debate over police methods. Not all of the news is particularly good. 86% said officers think their job is harder now as a consequence of these events, and an even larger share say that their fellow officers now feel less safe. Three-quarters say relations between police and blacks are more tense now, and 7 out of 10 officers say that their colleagues are less willing now to stop and question people who seem suspicious.
We've got this idea out there. Some police officers are just advising, I think we'll hear this in this hour, go fetal. Stay fetal. I don't get engaged. Did you see evidence in your survey that officers may be susceptible to that message?
That's a provocative word, but you won't find it in the Pew Research report. Certainly the fact that a significant majority of officers say they're less willing to stop and question people who seem suspicious follows in line with at least the sentiment, perhaps expressed a little too loudly, of that comment.
Wes, does there have to be a conflict, tension between do nothing and doing right?
I don't think there needs to be. I mean, I do think that what's fascinating about this report, and I think it's a really excellent survey because we very often do not hear directly from line officers. When we hear from police, we often hear from either police chiefs or union officials, both of whom can be a bit of caricatures in one direction or the other. And what was fascinating here was, you know, really hearing from line officers, whether their perceptions reflect reality or available data in some ways doesn't really matter, right? It is important to know what our police officers believe. And so if they believe that they need to be stepping back, or if they are reporting back to us that they are, it's a good thing for us to know.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking on this Martin Luther King Day about American policing now, where it's come in the era of Black Lives Matter, where it stands as Donald Trump prepares to take office on Friday, Inauguration Day. Wesley Lowery is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning national reporter for The Washington Post. He's been all over this. Rich Morin is with us from the Pew Research Center. They're out with a very interesting, big, new survey of 8,000 line police officers in this country. Loretta Lynch in Chicago last week to unveil the Justice Department's investigation into the Chicago PD. She opened with a broad comment on police and their communities well beyond Chicago.
One of my highest priorities as Attorney General has been to ensure that every American enjoys police protection that is lawful, that is responsive, and transparent. But as the events of recent years in Ferguson, in Baltimore, Cleveland, and many other cities have made clear, far too many Americans feel that they do not receive that kind of law enforcement. And far too many communities suffer because of painful divisions between police officers and citizens.
And we keep seeing new video out there. This is a little bit. Northwestern student Lawrence Crosby was arrested and beaten in Evanston, Illinois, just north of Chicago, of course, in October 2015 after somebody called 911 thinking he was stealing a car. It was his own car. The dash cam footage was just released last week. Here a CBS Chicago reporter describes the video. The voice you hear after the reporter is Brian Miller, the 9th Ward alderman who pushed for the video's release last week.
In October 2015, Crosby steps out of the car with his hands up. He's taken down by Evanston officers, struck multiple times, and he says he was kicked.
We need to do something about this issue in the city of Evanston, the de-escalation of the use of force by police officers, and we haven't actually. This video shows one of the most outrageous acts that I've seen from our officers so far.
Of course, a lot of police themselves have been attacked and died. There have been plenty of those. Wesley Lowery and others reporting on that as well. We want to hear from you in this hour. How do you see policing evolving in this country? What about respect for police? Where does that stand? Are we getting the balance right? Do you feel encouraged when we hear Chicago, Baltimore say they're going to revamp, reform? What Trump effect do you anticipate on American policing? Rich Moore and Wes Lowery, please stand by. Eugene O'Donnell joins us right now. He's a lecturer at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, former police officer in the NYPD. Eugene O'Donnell joins us today from London. Mr. O'Donnell, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Pew's out with this big survey, says police are more concerned about their safety. 93% are more concerned about their safety than ever. How do you see police morale in this time of so much microscopic scrutiny?
Oh, we have a giant crisis, particularly in urban America. Beyond those numbers, which are telling, and there are other surveys too, 90% of New York City cops have said they wouldn't recommend the job to anybody. We have a huge national recruiting crisis. You can't get anybody ambulatory to do the job, no matter how minimal the requirements. And as we make larger asks and bigger demands, it seems to be little reported that these pools are shrinking because the pyrotechnics and the divisive part of this gets all the attention. And the actual issue of how you proactively, affirmatively protect communities goes by the wayside. The Justice Department should be ashamed of that report, both in Baltimore and in Chicago.
Why?
To not do because there's a need to do a holistic. They're playing the role of, first of all, they're playing the role of, it's almost like a National Enquirer report. You use anecdotes. Millions of police contacts use anecdotes. But beyond that, this is dated news. The reality in the Chicago Police Department has collapsed. The Baltimore Police Department has collapsed.
What do you mean by collapse, Mr. O'Donnell? What do you mean by that?
I mean the 29% homicide conviction rate. Where's the Justice Department on that? Is it just the police that the Justice Department is targeting? There needs to be a reset here and a holistic review of this. And the reality is you had 3,500, 4,000 shootings in Chicago. You've had 30,000 murders since the 70s. And you're writing a report like that, which gives no nuance. And the reality is the police in Chicago, the stops have cratered. People are trying to get out of that job as fast as they can. Nobody wants to get into that job. They have a 60 college credit requirement they had to get rid of, like other cities, because there's no recruitment pool any longer. And we're going to have to talk about post-policing America and get real. And the Justice Department, it's ideological capture with that report.
Wesley Lauer, do you see a crisis in Chicago, Baltimore, elsewhere?
Well, I think police officials acknowledge that there is a crisis in policing, and it's certainly true that in many of these cities, police have pulled back. Now, whether or not that's something police should do or should not do, I think is a different question. You know, people don't like the media, but I can't sit at my desk with my arms crossed and not make any phone calls, right? But I do think it's important when we talk about the legitimacy of police to look at things like homicide clearance rates. I think Eugene's right. You know, in Chicago, police are clearing fewer than 3 in 10 homicides. That's half of the national rate.
Clearing, so, meaning finding...
Meaning arresting someone. Yep. And that's using the police definition of clearance. So not even really arresting. Sometimes they're pinning the homicide on a dead person, right? But using the most permissive definition of clearance, it's fewer than 3 in 10. And in neighborhoods that my colleagues and I did a neighborhood breakdown of this, in some of the most violent neighborhoods, you're talking about fewer than 1 in 10 homicides being cleared, right? And so you are a young person in Chicago, you're living in a place where you have almost no chance of justice. Now, I think about, I wonder what the role of the Department of Justice might be in solving that. Now, I don't know that, we do have to remember that the Department of Justice has the ability to critique police officers. I mean, the Department of Justice can issue a report about what the neighborhood should be doing differently, but who do they send that to? I do think that's kind of difficult. Of course, the police receive a certain level of scrutiny. They are paid by the taxpayers to maintain law and order and justice. And so if there is no law and order, that does fall on them. And so I do think that it's kind of difficult. I don't know who else the Department of Justice would be looking into but the police.
Rich Morin, in your big survey, did you find police saying that these problems are related to the scrutiny post-Ferguson, the Black Lives Matter kind of scrutiny of police operations, or not?
We did not specifically measure what the causes of these specific views were beyond the fact that they were responses to all of these events, not just Black Lives Matter, not just the protests, not just the national debate. Number of factors feed into these perceptions, many of which come straight off the street, as Wesley mentioned.
I'm looking here at one of the things you report. About a quarter of all white police officers, 27%, versus 7 in 10, or almost 70% of black colleagues, say that the protests after fatal encounters between police and black citizens have been motivated by a genuine desire to hold police accountable. Only about a quarter of white officers believe that. Black officers believe it overwhelmingly. That's pretty interesting, Rich.
Absolutely. In fact, I think the differences between black and white officers on a range of issues that touch on race or these events is probably the single most significant finding of this study. And we saw it all different ways. We saw it in the way that the police interpret these instances. For a majority of black officers say that these incidents are signs of a broader problem in society. And that view is held by only 27% of white officers.
Eugene, how about it? The effect of the protests that we've seen post-Ferguson and Baltimore and more. Are you drawing a line between those complaints and the problems in the police departments, or are these on separate tracks, Eugene?
Well, I think the conversation went completely off the rails, and the notion the police are like everybody else. Once you have statements like that, we've just had an ideological shouting match, nothing practical, nothing realistic, no effort to try to come to the middle. The most divisive things, the police shoot more whites than blacks. If you get into the statistics here, and the data here, that's what we need to be doing.
You're discounting the whole complaint about American police officers' treatment of minority Americans?
I think that's gotten a lot of worthwhile attention. I think if you go to the city of Chicago and you walk in the west side and you walk in the south side and you see that city is hollowed out, hundreds of thousands of African Americans and Latino people have hightailed it out of that city. If you walk on the streets of that city and you see the signs on every block almost in the south side, the west side, the block association saying this is the conduct we don't want on our block, the idea of making the police public enemy number one is totally out of touch with the community. A lot of this has been elitist driven. It hasn't been about solving problems. And again, for the Justice Department to go in and condemn the police people that are in the middle here is outrageous. And the president's commission a couple of years ago reported on where 21st century policing should look like. They didn't tell us where the cops are going to come from. So I'm still waiting to hear those who are critics telling us what pool of people we're going to get. You simply cannot say to police people who are willing to take physical risks in the most difficult circumstances that when they stop somebody and they use force, that you're going to treat that like somebody else using force, that you're going to treat that, you're going to be blind to the reality that there are surrogates and they use that force in our name and they detain people in our name and we pay them to go looking for trouble. That's not to say there's not a role for community policing, but in the cities that we're looking at, Chicago, Baltimore, the Justice Department, we could be gearing up here to be catching these shooters. Why is that not the dialogue at this point?
Wes Lowery,
those who carry weapons and have no fear.
Yeah, Wes, after all the work that you and your newspaper, The Washington Post, have done on this issue, how does it feel to hear Eugene O'Donnell call this a kind of elitist-driven obsession?
Well, I appreciate him citing our data. When we first started collecting this data, we were told how anti-police it was to even want to know how many people the police were killing. But I have appreciated that so many police chiefs and other people have now seen the value that if we're going to talk about police shootings, we might as well at least know how many people are being killed. It is true that more white people are killed by the police. It's also true that there are tens of millions of more white people in the United States of America, right? When we look at, so I just have to correct that, right? When we look at percentages of the population, black people are killed drastically disproportionately. Proportionally. And also when we look at unarmed people, so not bank robbers, not people in a shootout, but someone with nothing in their hands, a black person is much more likely to be killed, right? So that I think that has to be clarified. But I also think that I do think it's important to have those conversations. And while I appreciate people talking about the need to talk about data, we've seen Donald Trump is coming in and he said he doesn't believe that that local police departments should have to report their data to the federal government, right? We're going to take steps
backwards.
Why
not? What's the rationale?
Because this is a local government issue. I mean, he's pandering to police chiefs and police unions who do not want accountability, right? I mean, we have full departments that refuse to disclose the names of officers who kill people, right? It's not the idea that police need to be held to the same standard as everyone else. If they need to be held to any standard at all. If I kill someone, it's not like that my name's never going to be released, right? There's no similar standard here. There were 990 fatal police shootings in 2015, 940 something in 2016. There were two dozen people charged with, two dozen officers charged with crimes for those shootings. To compare that to the public at large, where almost every person who kills someone is charged with the crime, we know those are different worlds and different standards. And I think most people aren't even advocating for most officers to be charged in these cases, but the idea that perhaps we should know how often people are being killed by the police or who the people doing the killing are, if they've killed before. And that also, if we don't have that information, how might we begin to have a conversation about policies that change things?
Seems reasonable to at least know. But I mean, here was FBI Director James Comey. He was in Chicago. This is a little over a year ago, but he was talking with a group of police chiefs there. He warned that there's a chill wind blowing through America post-Ferguson, preventing police, he said, from doing their jobs.
I spoke to officers privately in one big city precinct who described being surrounded by young people with mobile phones held high, taunting them when they get out of their cars. They said to me, "We feel under siege and we don't feel much like getting out of our cars."
Well, when they do get out, we'd like them to do the right thing, whatever that is. Samuel in Miami, Florida. Samuel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Let me establish right up front, one, I'm white as the day is long. I have spent the past 62 years in Miami, Florida, a southern city which some will claim is a suburb of New York. And with the exception of 7 years living in the Bahamas, i.e., I lived in a black country, but I'm a white man, and I experienced the other side of it in some respects. What I am tired of hearing from too many white Americans is Black Lives Matter is a problem. Excuse me. It didn't take me long to figure out that Black Lives Matter was saying Black Lives also matter. Or as I heard from a black comedian at a later point, Black Lives matter just as much. I can't believe that so many Americans, and it's not just the police, are culturally deaf and culturally blind to the fact that black Americans do not have the same equal expectations living in our country. We are, by and large, unfortunately, a racist society. We're not racist.
Samuel, what are you thinking when you hear Eugene O'Donnell suggest, and Mr. O'Donnell, correct me if I'm wrong, but suggest that a big focus on this ends up shutting down police or even discouraging people from joining police in the first place? What are you thinking when you hear that? We just have to work through that or what?
Again, they are culturally deaf and blind. And I don't know how it actually infuriates me.
Yeah.
That I hear police union personnel again say, "Oh, the police." Excuse me. The union personnel are on the far end of what I see as the problem. I think most police officers are okay, but they are in the midst of a cultural situation, and I have black police friends, a couple, and I also am beholden to having policemen protected me and my father and my family over the last 60-some years, stopped armed robberies, always by white people, but inevitably people will ask, was it a, and they use the N-word.
Yeah.
Never in the 4 or 5 times that we were subject to armed robberies was it ever anybody but a white person.
Samuel, we got it from Miami. Eugene O'Donnell, do I have it right? Are you suggesting that this focus on inequities and perceived inequities in policing is a negative thing? I mean, do we have a problem here? If we do, can't we take it on?
Yeah, well, this is just a loop. We keep doing this. We need a day-long show to get into these conversations. The Pew Research, by the way, shows that most of the cops think the public doesn't know their work. And, of course, it's true. They have a conflictive adversarial job. They get called to go to places. And when you look at where they go, put it up on a map in a place like Chicago or Baltimore, it's a relatively small number of streets, actually, in the whole city. The cops are constantly on, and they're cheek to jowl with people that are carrying guns because they're not getting caught. And if you look at the victims, almost every single victim is African-American or Latino and young, male, not women, male. And this oversimplification that Wesley just did does this conversation
no justice? You're saying just live with it?
The truth is we need to have 8 hours of conversation on this.
Yeah.
But that's not really what drives the ratings and drives the cable.
Hey, listen, we're in the middle of it right here, and we're going to do more right after a break. So, you know, it's not like we're skittering away. We're drilling in, and we're happy to have you here to help do that. Eugene O'Donnell with John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Please stand by there in London, Rich Moore, and with the Pew Research Center, Wes Lowry with the Washington Post. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about American policing. Years now after Ferguson, on this Martin Luther King Day 2017, where it's come, where it's headed, the problems out there right now, a big new research survey by the Pew Research Center of 8,000 American police, all kinds of interesting detail into how they are thinking as the magnifying glass has been on them. Eugene O'Donnell is with us. He's a lecturer at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, former police officer in the New York City Police Department. He's talking about go fetal, stay fetal as an attitude that some police are adopting under the scrutiny of the Black Lives Matter movement. Wesley Lowry was there kind of from the beginning of this wave of super attention. He was in Ferguson, arrested there all the way back in 2014, won a Pulitzer Prize since then, along with others at the Washington Post for his reporting on this. His book is They Can't Kill Us All. You can join us this hour. Do you feel encouraged when we hear Chicago, Baltimore, others say they're going to revamp, reform? What Trump effect do you anticipate here? Police, do you hear this go fetal, stay fetal idea out there, or is that exaggerated? And how do we get to safe streets, good policing, and justice for all? Patrice Cullors, co-founder of Black Lives Matter, last fall was giving a TED Talk with a couple of others about how she felt, what it was like for her growing up, her youth, and policing.
I grew up in a neighborhood that was heavily policed. I witnessed my brothers and my siblings continuously stop and frisked by law enforcement. I remember my home being raided. And one of the questions as a child I had was why? Why us? Black Lives Matter offers answers to the why.
Is it easy for police out there? It is not. Here was CBS News this morning last November reporting on that day on four police officers shot in four cities within 24 hours.
At least four police officers were shot in a wave of unrelated attacks around the country targeting law enforcement. A gunman ambushed a St. Louis police sergeant late last night, shooting him twice in the face. Another officer was shot and wounded in Gladstone, Missouri during a traffic stop.
A suspect is in custody for shooting a Sanibel, Florida police officer also during a traffic stop. The officer is expected to survive. But in San Antonio, Texas, a massive manhunt is underway for a gunman who ambushed and killed a detective.
Eugene O'Donnell there in London, a couple of our listeners, well, lots of them actually, but here's a couple that are comments aimed at you. Melissa writes to us. She said, your officer guest is woefully mistaken on Baltimore. I'm a decade-long city resident. Constitutional policing isn't elitist. And Paul asks, so police can't do their job unless they can shoot and beat citizens with impunity? What do you say to those, Eugene?
Again, this requires time, but if you understand the work, you understand that, well, it requires a lot of time. For young people going to police work, they're always shocked to find out the difference between being in uniform and what they thought the job was before they went on there. But the job involves conflict, adversarial interactions with people. You're operating in a vacuum. Today you have people frontally, verbally attacking you, waving cameras in your face.
Well, Melissa just says constitutional policing is not elitist.
You could teach a course on constitutional policing that would take five semesters. The issues of stop and frisk, the issues of the constitutionality of interrogation, street-side interrogation, and when you can do searches and things like that, very complicated matter. And even when you talk about the Constitution, again, this is where the Justice Department really – Justice Department, by the way, which does not work with a velvet glove. Don't forget, this is the agency that has the FBI.
Sure.
The FBI – if the FBI is in an adversarial interaction, the FBI is going to be vindicated by the Justice Department. But the reality is constitutional issues and the niceties of the constitutional stuff, which takes up thousands and thousands of appellate decisions. Cops on the street are there making these decisions in real time, dealing with the possibility of injury and death, being lied to every day to their faces. And
are you saying we should not expect constitutional policing? It's too much to expect?
We should have a national, honest conversation about what that
is. But you seem like you're dancing around that question.
It's not as easy as it sounds.
I don't mean it's easy.
Not as easy. Well, it's a complicated issue because uppermost in the minds of the cops is their safety. So when this whole video culture now, yep, that when you know the result, you can critique what the cops are doing is really misleading because the cops never know the result.
Yeah.
And as you see, if you study these shootings,
yep,
the most pedestrian, most nonsensical interaction can lead to a fatal shooting where the cops are being fired upon or somebody else is injured.
Mm. Rich Moran, in your big Pew survey, do the police that you talk to, 8,000, that's a lot, do they think we have a problem with constitutional policing? Do they think there's been progress made, if there is or has been a problem?
We didn't specifically ask officers what they thought of constitutional policing, but we did test the receptivity to a variety of police reforms. And we found in the main that officers accepted a number of reforms and what would might be argued a more modern views of policing. But we also found that significantly smaller percentages said their departments encouraged people who acted in these in these ways. So there's a little bit of disconnect that we found between the the officer on the street and the administration of many of these departments.
Ron in Augusta, Georgia. Ron, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you see? What do you think?
Hi, Tom. What I think is that when you have a situation where you have an unarmed confrontation and then you end up shooting the person 15 times, multiple times, 15 times has been a couple of the statements. Then you wonder, well, now you can't even get the witness or the individual who was in the confrontation to even state anything. I mean, that is what you say. Okay, you shoot the person one time, and then you disable them, then you take them to the hospital, and you continue the rule of law. But in this case, it's the police go through a situation, they have the confrontation, they overreact, and lo and behold, there's nothing that can be done because the witness is gone.
Yeah. Wes Lowry, are you sympathetic when Eugene O'Donnell says, look, you don't know if you're not there. You don't know how it is, how it was.
Well, I mean, I certainly think it's true that we ask police to do a hard job and police sign up to do that very difficult job, you know, but I do think that I think it's hard when we, you know, I forget what exact words were, but he said something along the lines of, you know, that constitutional stuff. I mean, that is, you know, the law of the land, you know, the utmost law of the land, you know, that is what ensures justice and for all, you know, the Constitution. And so it is important that, you know, our police officers are, you know, abiding by that. And we can debate over what that is, right? So something like stop and frisk, you know, we can have a constitutional debate over whether or not it's constitutional or not. But I do think it's important. I think that what's fascinating when we look at the Pew research of officers, how different the police feel than the public does, right? That many, when you look at the Pew reports looking at what the public in general believes, you know, twice as many Americans in general believe that, you know, these shootings are part of a deeper, more systemic issue than police officers themselves do, right? That there is a disconnect, and it's not just some elitist rebel rousers, but rather the American people want some level of police reform, want an increased level of accountability, and do think that many of these interactions are about deep systemic issues and are not just one-off bad apple officers.
Eugene says we're headed into or maybe in a crisis where police, either people don't want to sign up in the first place to be police or, you know, he's saying that the big thing you hear out of Chicago is go fetal, stay fetal, don't get engaged. I mean, is it possible that we get to a place where people are... rather than making progress and doing it right, we lean toward paralysis of some kind, Wes.
Well, I think that there's agreement broadly that we are in the midst of some level of crisis, something we haven't seen in a long time, and that crisis.
Define it.
Well, I think it's a crisis of police legitimacy. I think it's one in which you have, and I think many officers and chiefs agree with this, that whether they believe it's because of the constant showing of these videos, or if they believe it's too much coverage of a few bad instances, or, as other people might argue, because of a lack of ability to solve crimes, and only exacerbated now by a slowdown of officers in places like Baltimore and Chicago, what we are seeing in reality is police officers who do not feel empowered to do their jobs, and what that is leading to, what it seems to be leading to in some capacity, the jury's still out on some of this, is a world in which fewer crimes are being solved, and that incentivizes people committing crimes. I mean, I don't think that's a world any of us want to live in.
I mean, Chicago, 2016, most violent year in two decades. Police morale, I don't know, but officers were making about 50,000 street stops per month before the Laquan McDonald video came out. After that came out, that figure dropped to about 10,000, from 50,000 to 10,000. Interesting. Bobby in Corinth, Mississippi. Bobby, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. Tom, I have a whatnot/small antique store in this town.
Okay.
And we have officers coming through on Route 72 to go to the casinos when they're either off duty or on sick leave.
Okay.
In the last 8 to 10 months, I've had 3 officers come in who identified themselves as officers, 2 black officers, 1 white officer.
All right.
And they're getting to the point where they don't want to engage these people. Because now they're using the N-word, but they talk to black people, they talk to good white people both, and they say, the black people say, these people that are causing all the problem are the common street and then the N-word, okay? And they ruin it for what we and a lot of other people are trying to do and make headway in life.
But if they're talking about African-American fellow citizens with the N-word, isn't that a pretty gigantic indicator right off the bat that there's a problem, Bobby?
Well, that's what they're doing. I mean, that's what they say off the record, this is what's going on, and they don't want to engage these people because they fear for their lives. They don't know if they're coming home at night. They wait, and they let them go and beat each other up or shoot each other, and they kind of feel it's kind of like nature's way of thinning out the bad.
Oh, do you buy that, Bobby?
Well, you know, I listened to them, and I didn't buy it at first, but after 3 officers, it makes you sit and wonder, why would you risk your life? Now, these officers are mid-40s to early 50s.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get to thinking about that for a minute, and, you know, nature has this way of thinning out animals and whatnot.
That's pretty rough. I mean, that's not the way a civilized society is supposed to be structured and set up. Rich Morin, do you see that sort of racial attitude reflected in your survey?
No, we don't. No. In the main, the impression that we came away with was much like Wesley described. These are professionals in a tough job. One officer told me that police see things the public doesn't see and things the public shouldn't see. That has an effect. I mean, and the effects aren't necessarily all that good. We found that a majority of officers say they become more callous on the job. And that's a direct reflection of some of the other data. A third of officers in the past month said that they have physically struggled or fought with someone. And in the past month, a majority of officers had those kinds of verbal confrontations with citizens that Wesley was describing. All of that has an effect. And, you know, there's a life on the street and there's another life, an ideal to which we aspire. I'm not ready to give up on the fact that the aspiration is still there, even though in practice there are many, many problems.
Alita in Normal, Illinois. Alita, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I sympathize so greatly with the Black Lives Matter movement, but I also spent a few years as a correctional officer, so I'm really familiar with the idea that you could be jumped at any time. And I sympathize also with the many good police officers. I just am really disappointed that a lot of the conversation revolves around the supposition that these officers are demoralized and more scared of being shot with a cell phone camera than with a personal firearm. I think that we need to revisit the real culprit here, which is the obstinate mischief of the NRA in regulating ammunition and firearms in this country.
Resisting that regulation. Alita, I appreciate your call. I mean, they may not want to be shot with a smartphone, but I'm sure they're more concerned about a firearm in the end. Eugene O'Donnell, do you see positive progress somehow as the nation tries to take racial justice into account alongside police practice, or are you just here to tell us it's all going the wrong way somehow?
Yeah, because the conversation's a terrible conversation. You just heard some of it there with the reference to the N-word. Extremism begets extremism. Extremists took over this conversation and, you know, in some ways probably fueled Trump's election to the White House. Mrs. Clinton wouldn't even meet with the police unions. That's where she put herself in this conversation. And we saw hate speech against the police repeated promiscuously. And we saw moral equivalence arguments. You kill one of us, we'll kill two of you. I think the guy who did his shooting in the poor soul who's obviously emotionally disturbed, but said the police are devils. Go onto social media and see the kinds of outrageous things that are uttered over and over again against the police. So, but again, I hate to point fingers at the media, but the reality is I've been in the middle of it. I know the media loves to hit the racial divisive stuff here. The Washington Post has tried to pin down this idea the police are just promiscuously murdering people. They didn't do it. They couldn't do it because it's not really there. When you look at all the interactions the police have, they just couldn't pull that off. And, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times editorial board never editorialized affirmatively how to protect society.
Eugene, I got to give
us take pot shots and critiques.
I got to give Wes
police.
A chance. Wes, you got
to get a holistic.
Got it. We got it. Wes, we got half a minute here. What do you say to that? And where are we headed under Trump?
I'm not in the prediction game. I have no idea where we're headed under Trump.
Yeah, but you just had a pretty big charge kind of leveled from
Of
Eugene.
Course. And you know what? And now I'm not going to do any more reporting because that scrutiny is just going to keep me from being able to do my job. I'm going to sit at my desk. I'm not going to make any calls. See, that's the ridiculousness of this argument. And at the end of the day...
Nuance, Wes. Nuance.
Okay.
Do some nuance. Do some
serious. You'll be out there reporting, Wes. Like. Do you see progress, Wesley Lowry?
It's a good story. All right.
Yes, and we're very fortunate that many chiefs and officers do not hold the views that have just been stated by our friend Eugene.
But in the Trump administration, do you think that these consent decrees will continue to be active? They'll continue to push for this kind of reform?
I do not believe the Trump administration will continue to push for this type of reform. However, I do expect that in many cases, many police chiefs, some unions and many activists on the ground will very likely keep up some of this work.
Wesley Lowry, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for The Washington Post. We thank you for joining us today, Wes.
Thank you.
Eugene O'Donnell with John Jay College of Criminal Justice and Rich Morin at the Pew Research Center. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.